Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put a little context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, former Mandela aide Zelda Lakhranji on a scam she says she should have seen coming. SADC is talking integration at the end of the summit, but where are the economic results? Fly Safair's future faces a major competition test. And South Africa is still the continent's wealth capital, but where is the money really being made? It's Wednesday, the 19th of August. Now, if you think you're too savvy to fall for a scam, well, take a listen to this. Former aide to Nelson Mandela, Zelda Lakhranji, has a warning. The author and speaker says she lost 6,000 rand after a convincing caller posing as a Vodacom agent told her she'd won an iPhone, grocery vouchers, and cash. She says the operation sounded legitimate, right down to the call center environment, but she also admits she's furious with herself for falling for it. And she's now speaking publicly because she says she doesn't want others making the same mistake. Zelda, a very warm welcome to you, and you say you should have known better. In the first instance, what made you believe them?
Well, firstly, that they had my name and my number, because the number, I've never received spam calls on this number. And then immediately the guy tells me, you know, this call is recorded. So he uses all the right language. Then he goes over and he says that, you know, remember, Vodacom will never ask for your personal details. So he's so sophisticated. He's so eloquent in his speech that you believe, you know, that this person is for real.
Was there any point in this conversation when something might have felt wrong, but you ignored it?
Well, the fact that I picked up the phone, that's where where you should actually start. I mean, it's not great to admit that you've been so stupid. But as you say, I want people to know that, you know, when you answer a call, you know, be polite, because I also feel sorry for people in call centers, because they have to deal with rude people all day. But it's so, you know, our society is in such a state that you can't trust people anymore. So just, I should have said politely, thank you very much, but I'll go to Vodacom and I'll hear what I have. But the excitement and then greed, you know, greed is part of everyday life for all of us, and people are suffering. So if it was so easy to convince me into something like this, you know, it could be, other people could be very, very vulnerable as well. But at that point, you know, when you pick up the phone, you should know, you know, to be alert and to be assertive. But I gave him time to talk, because he caught me at a very at the end of the day, at a very vulnerable moment. You know, I was just off the call with someone else, and I decided, let me listen to this guy, what he's got to say. I mean, I'm not even an iPhone user, so I'm already thinking, when he offers me the iPhone, I'm already thinking who I'm going to give this iPhone to, who needs an iPhone, who's an iPhone user in my friend circle of friends. So, you know, immediately your mind goes, and then, as I say, you know, greed is a terrible thing. I'm thinking what I can do with 30,000 rand now. So yeah, it's terrible. It's a terrible situation.
It takes some courage for a person to blame their own greed. You don't think you're being a little hard on yourself?
Well, I have to be hard on myself, because, you know, I should know better. I've always said that I'd never be caught. I thought I was savvy. I thought I'm street smart, but clearly I'm not. So, you know, I like being hard on myself, because it's the only time I learn my lesson. And, you know, I mean, people are, I'm not, the 6,000 rand is not making or breaking me, but it's an inconvenience. And for any other person, it could be make or break. And I don't want other people to have to go through this. And that's why I'm speaking up, even at my own expense.
Zelda, let me rewind slightly. What exactly did they persuade you to do that cost you 6,000 rand?
that's the problem. You know, on my banking app, I've never used any features of payments or vouchers or anything. So when he asked me to go into the banking app, he also said to me, remember, Vodacom will never ask for your personal details or login details. So you are at ease. I go into my banking app and now I'm buying iVouchers, something I've never done before. By now, I've moved into my computer because he just gave me a reference number for the iPhone that I want that I could go and pick up at the closest Vodacom shop close to me. And he knows exactly where I should pick up this phone. So again, you know, it completely puts you at ease. And then I'm into my banking app and he says I must buy these vouchers and I buy the vouchers. And then he asks for a reference number. As I've never used this feature, I quite comfortably gave him the reference number. And then as I sit in front of my computer, because now I'm writing down stuff, I get two emails from my bank to say that these vouchers, you know, have been allocated to me. So I don't think the money has left my account now. And then when he went over to the e-wallet, which I have used before, he asked me to enter someone else's cell phone number for e-wallet. And I said, no, wait. I've used this before. This is not how it's supposed to be. By then I suspected, you know, there's something wrong here. But then the pressure, you know, I don't panic well. That's my other thing. I know I don't panic well. So now he's putting pressure on me. Ma'am, the system is running. You know, if we cut the call now, we can't, the money won't be paid to you. And we have to start the process all over and you lose the whole deal. And so now I'm anxious as well. So I give him the e-wallet reference as well. And then I realized, because then I get a notification from my bank that this money has been, you know, it's out of my account. And then immediately I knew, okay, I've been scammed. So I put down the phone and I rushed to the closest store to go in and try and cash in the vouchers. But it was, Jeremy, it was literally 10 minutes later and the vouchers were cashed in already.
Do you think, Zelda, the banking system should have stopped this sooner? You do say your bank did pick up suspicious activity towards the end of this.
I don't know how they would know. You know, I don't know because on any given day you can go onto your banking app and do stuff. But I don't know how they would know if a person from a new number calls, because they change numbers also all the time. So I don't know what the solution is. I laid charges. I opened a case at the police station. And hopefully if enough people complain about the situation, because you can see on my initial Facebook page, there's really hundreds and thousands of people that's been scammed. So if we all lay charges, the police can't ignore it because these people need to be caught.
Do you think there is a responsibility that telecom companies have when criminals impersonate their brand so convincingly?
I also think so. That's why I reported it immediately with Vodacom. And the Vodacom actually responded. There's a website on which you can report it. And Vodacom responded immediately and gave me also their case number. And the next day they blocked the numbers already. So I tried to call them and the numbers were disconnected. So I do think, you know, if someone, because it seems that the Vodacom scam is a thing that happens these days. And if they work together with the police and together with the bank, surely they should be able to trace these people and catch them.
Has this changed the way that you trust legitimate banks, retailers and call centers?
Yeah, now it's a whole new different thing for me. You know, I don't answer calls. I'm not good at answering my phone as it is. But yesterday, someone called from a call center, you know, a company I use, and I said, I'm sorry, I'll go to the shop or the company if I need anything. I'm sorry, I'm not interested. And I feel sorry for the call center people because they have to deal, you know, with the consequences of all of this, not being trusted and people being rude to them. So, but definitely, I'll be, you know, I won't answer phones and I'm not winning anything. You know, I know I don't often win or I've never won anything in my life. So this was too good to be true. And you know how the saying goes, if it's too good to be true, it is.
Precisely. Zelda Lakhranji, thank you very much indeed. Appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Southern African leaders have wrapped up another SADC summit with a long list of commitments on trade, on infrastructure, industrialization and regional integration. And this time I think there are some tangible promises, from one-stop border posts and fewer trade barriers to a regional development fund and a new tourism visa. But President Ramaphosa himself admitting that integration between the members is moving too slowly. I want to talk to Joseph Matola now. He's head of the Economic Resilience and Inclusion Program at the South African Institute of International Affairs. Joseph, welcome to you. And strip away the summit language. Why is it still so difficult to do business with the country next door?
Like you've pointed out, integration has been really slow. And when we talk about integration, we're talking about having the systems that allow for seamless trade, that allow for seamless movement of people from one country to another, that allows for a seamless movement of capital. All these ingredients that are needed for proper international trading and international travel and so on and so forth. But unfortunately, implementation of the projects that are supposed to allow for this further integration, including the one border post that you've just mentioned, it's been slow. There has been some border posts that have been the one-stop border post that have been established. But what you see in there is that much as this has improved some of the inefficiencies that were there, but there's still room for more improvement in integrating the systems to make sure that the transit times are cut even shorter.
So more broadly then, it's not a lack of policy. You're suggesting the systems are there. Is the problem then governments simply not implementing what they have already agreed to?
I would say yes and no. So it's not for a lack of policy. There's been all these agreements that member states have signed on to. The issue of one border post, for example, has been going on for quite a long time. There's been some projects that have been underway for way too long. You know, they should have been completed as of now. I think the main problem is governments being able to put aside enough funding for these projects that have been agreed at the SADC level. So financing is one of the major challenges. It's not for a lack of policies. The policies as they are there. The projects have been identified that SADC members should invest in. The problem is for some of these projects to take off and for those that have taken off already to be completed in time.
So it always, as with most things in life, comes down to the money. You're suggesting that it's all about funding, but I imagine funding priorities would be internally directed by many governments, which I guess in this geopolitical climate is fairly understandable.
Yeah, it's fairly understandable. Many countries, many member states in the SADC region and in Africa, they face fiscal problems. They just don't have the fiscal space to set aside enough funds for these quite ambitious projects by their standards. So, for example, a lot of countries, they still run budget deficits of say, over 3% of their GDP. And that's above the SADC target. You want to have deficits that are lower than that. Many countries are still facing debt problems. Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique, and they're spending a lot of money servicing this debt. So for them to commit to funding some of these projects, it's a problem. But SADC has recognized that, and they have tried to put in some solutions. For example, the establishment of the regional the SADC Regional Development Fund, which is expected to be capitalized by about $13 billion. That could be a solution to that, and some of those funds can be used to implementing these projects. I think what would be important is to make sure that they can mobilize the private sector to invest in this fund. I think relying on national budgets to pour resources into these funds is not going to be as successful. They have to focus on the private sector to to generate funding for this project.
And in theory, the regional development fund that you talk about is a good idea. It is supposed to help finance infrastructure and industrialization, but it still needs countries to ratify it. We've got to ask why it's taken so long and how seriously then business should take any kind of commitment like this if there is a time lag.
Yes, I think that's a worrying. That's the worrying thing. I think this should be a straightforward initiative, but I know at this summit there's been emphasis on to get countries that have not yet ratified the agreement on the RDF to ratify it so that it can enter into force. Yeah, like you're saying, I mean it puts. Maybe it discourages some investors to put their trust into this fund and to put their funds into this initiative. So I think it's something that moving forward, the new chair has to emphasize and has to push hard for countries to ratify this so that we can generate the funds that we need. Because you have to remember that there is a lot of funds. There is a lot of capital on the African continent. The problem is that it's invested elsewhere. It's invested outside the continent. I think the African Development Bank estimates that over $3 trillion dollars of African capital is invested outside the continent. Obviously, for the SADC region, it would be a smaller amount than that. But there is a lot of capital that is available in the region that can be redirected to this fund.
Thank you very much indeed for the insight and analysis. That is Joseph Matolo, who's head of the Economic Resilience and Inclusion Program at the South African Institute of International Affairs. Building wealth doesn't happen by chance. It happens by making the right decisions. Join John Manyike from Old Mutual at the MoneyWeb Economy and Investing Conference at the Money Summit as he shares practical strategies for building long-term wealth, avoiding common investment mistakes, and creating lasting financial success in the real world. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Center. Register for free using the promo code MoneyWeb. Secure your seat today. Go to moneyweb.co.za and start building a stronger financial future.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, the proposed takeover of Fly SAF Air by Harith Aviation is facing a real challenge at the Competition Tribunal. The Competition Commission has recommended approval with conditions, but rival SEMAIR says Harith's interests in Lanseria Airport create potentially dangerous overlaps in an already concentrated aviation market. I want to get another perspective on the story. Respected aviation expert and editor of SA Flyer magazine, Guy Leach, welcome back to the program. Let's strip away all the legal language. Do you think this deal makes South African aviation more or less competitive?
Yeah. Hi, Jeremy. I fear that it makes it a lot less competitive simply because in aviation, there's one singular broad rule, and that is that airlines should not own airports. Airports are fundamentally monopolies, and it gives any airline that's in bed with an airport an unfair advantage. That's why we've already seen the Competition Commission already issuing, in a sense, a warning or a request for at least a fuzzy promise from Harith that they will play fair. Personally, that doesn't really give me a lot of comfort. And then, of course, the whole deal is also really very questionable because Harith, as we all know, uses PIC funds. And PIC funds are essentially government funds. And the accusation is then that this will make Fly SAF Air essentially a state-owned airline. All of this is obviously bad for competition.
Guy, aside from the PIC component, owning an airline and having an economic interest in an airport, as you're suggesting, is an uncomfortable concentration of that power. How would that impact a passenger, for instance? Why would we need to be worried about that?
Well, passengers, being an airline passenger, is all about convenience and connectivity. So in other words, you want to be able to fly an airline at your time to your destination directly. And the moment you start getting airlines and airports concentrating power, then they're going to limit connectivity. They're going to push up the rates that they're charging from that airport. Up to now, Safair has basically, since COVID and the loss of Kulula and Mango, had pretty much a monopoly at Lanseria already. That's, funnily enough, just about to end now, because for the first time ever, Airlink has moved into that gap and is now, is going to launch in November, a direct Lanseria Harare flight, which is great news. But, it's difficult for these airlines to operate from a new place like Lanseria, simply because all their routes, all their connectivity is through our Tambo already. In other words, these regional airlines look to feed and defeed the long-haul carriers, and that means they need to operate from the main airports. It's bad news for instance, if Lyft wanted to start operating out of Lanseria as well, I suspect that they would find the door not quite as welcoming as it perhaps should be.
Guy, maybe tell us how important, in terms of bigger aviation, Lanseria Airport is, given that the Competition Commission says there's no real incentive for Harith to, in its words, disadvantage rival airlines at Lanseria. Obviously, you're not buying that argument.
Well, I mean, the Competition Commission, it does have a point in that, what's good for the airport will be good for the airlines as well. So the argument would be that, well, if the more airlines that come in to use Lanseria, the better it is for Lanseria. And that argument has to have some element of validity. My question, though, is that if you believe that capitalism is all about the bottom line, well, then it's also natural that both Harith and Fly Safair will seek to protect essentially the stranglehold they will have over Lanseria. So, I mean, yeah, you can make that argument. Whether we believe it or not is up to the listener. But certainly, as I said, the global precedent, and it's been is that airlines shouldn't be in bed with airports. I think Lanseria is really important. It is a competitor to our Tambo, so in a sense, there's a balance there. But it also, we must understand that it feeds or supplies or services the entire northwest of Johannesburg, and it's a lot more convenient for passengers in terms of your ability to pretty much arrive at the airport 15 minutes before the flight departs. That's not something you can't consider at our Tambo. So that element of convenience needs to really be protected. I'm not sure that the Competition Commission is doing that.
The Commission, Guy, is insisting on conditions, as I understand it, particularly in the sharing of information and fair access. But I guess we've got to ask the question whether those behavioural conditions are actually enforceable, or are the regulators just asking competitors to trust that everyone's going to behave? And I don't think that's likely to happen.
I agree with you. I don't think it's going to happen. It was couched in what I described earlier as a warm fuzzy. It was kind of like, kindly please promise us that you'll play nicely and share information. Airlines are notoriously reluctant to share information. It's extremely difficult to get current information. Yes, there are global aggregators that do provide information, but it's always at least a month or two old in terms of loads, in terms of yields, and so on. And we've quite often seen airlines just quietly consolidating flights when they don't have enough passengers, which would indicate poor loads. But as I said, they're because the only differentiator is so often price, the airlines are extremely reluctant to actually share their yields and share what they're actually getting and paying. And let me point out something else, and that is that fuel is an immense variable. Every airline pays a different amount for fuel. They negotiate fuel supplies or their fuel price with the suppliers. So that is a huge unknown in the whole equation. And the airport will just shrug their shoulders and say, oh, I'm sorry, well, we can't tell you what fuel price others are paying, because they also control the fuel through Lanseria.
And Guy, just a final question, or maybe a counterpoint. Harith could bring capital to Fly Safair as well as South African ownership. Is there a danger, a risk, of regulating away precisely the investment that the South African aviation industry needs right now?
That's a good question, because personally I'm opposed to the 75% rule which was one of the factors that, and sorry, the 75% rule is a rule that South African airlines have to be 75% locally owned by a South African resident. And that rule is particularly onerous by world standards. Most countries have a 51% simple majority rule or else none at all. And yet it was this rule and the ongoing fight that FlySafe Air had with the International Air Services Council about their foreign ownership that probably precipitated this sale from the Irish Air Services leasing company to Harith. And bear in mind that there would have been a massive outflow of capital attached to that as well, also not good for the balance of trade. So all in all, this wholesale may not have been a good thing, and particularly because, look, the Harith is, they argue otherwise, but we have no reason to not believe that they are still running PIC funds, Public Investment Corporation funds, in other words, state pensioners funds, as investments, and that means that they are investing in airlines, and airlines are notoriously bad investments. So the whole thing is not a happy arrangement as far as I'm concerned.
Guy Leach is the editor of SA Flyer magazine. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Africa may struggle with poverty and weak growth, but it's also home to an extraordinary concentration of private wealth. The latest Africa Wealth Report puts the continent's wealth at $3.1 trillion, with 127,000 dollar millionaires, and South Africa remains comfortably number one, accounting for around 38% of them. Johannesburg, not surprisingly, is still Africa's wealthiest city, although Cape Town is forecast to overtake it by 2030, so just around the corner. So what does this wealth actually tell us about the health of the economy? Let's welcome back to our program Andrew Amoyles, who's head of research at New World Wealth. Andrew, welcome. And it's always anomalous. How can South Africa be Africa's greatest wealth powerhouse when, as we well know, our economy has struggled to grow and unemployment remains so extraordinarily high? There's a real dichotomy there, isn't there?
Absolutely. Well, Africa has struggled, obviously, since the global financial crisis. It hasn't had the kind of growth that Asia's had. So a lot of the African economies have fallen quite far behind. And South Africa has been more resilient than most. The other big African economies like Nigeria, Egypt, have really struggled since the financial crisis. Their currencies have depreciated massively, and they've had a lot of political instability. And I think that's kind of pulled South Africa to the fore. Another thing that South Africa's got that a lot of other African countries don't is it's got very well established luxury residential areas. It's the Western Cape is a very popular lifestyle destination for high net worths from all over the world. And the rest of Africa doesn't tend to have that. There is a bit of it in places like Mauritius, in Marrakesh and Morocco. It's starting to happen a bit in Namibia. But South Africa's really got a massive head start over the rest of the countries in Africa in terms of appeal to high net worth individuals.
Does that tell us then that South Africa is good at creating wealth or just really good at concentrating it among a relatively small group or number of people?
Well, South Africa has got 10 billionaires, so that's not a massive number considering the number of high net worths it's got. So I wouldn't say it's slanted towards the top end. I think it's a pretty regular wealth distribution among the high net worths. So I would say that the key factors in terms of South Africa appealing to that many high net worths is, as I mentioned, some of those factors about luxury residential areas. Also, it's got a very highly diversified economy. So a lot of the other African countries are very reliant on certain sectors, whereas in South Africa, most of the sectors are very well developed. And that's probably the reason why there are so many high net worths as well.
Am I correct in saying that the definition excludes property, private business, and private equity? If that's the case, would that give us a very different picture from someone's actual net worth?
Yes. There's 127,000 high net worth individuals living in Africa. About 48,000 in South Africa, but that's just people with liquid wealth. So that's including equity holdings, cash holdings mainly. If you were to include property holdings and family businesses, private equity, remember those assets are much more difficult to value, first of all. So there's a lot more guesswork involved. But the number would probably be 3-4 times higher, the number of high net worths, if you were to include those assets.
Andrew, let me circle back to Johannesburg. Just over 11,000 high net worth individuals, in spite of two difficult economic decades. Again, you did mention the difference between Johannesburg and Cape Town, but what keeps wealthy people here when commentary does suggest that money and skill is moving to Cape Town?
Well, Johannesburg was way ahead of Cape Town 10, 20 years ago, mainly because a lot of the wealthy people were based in Johannesburg, but they had homes in Cape Town. So there was always Cape Town was the second home hotspot. But increasingly, the last 20 years, people have increasingly moved to Cape Town as their permanent address, and that's obviously boosted their numbers. And remember, our numbers for Cape Town, we're not including the Cape Winelands in there, and we're not including places like Amanus, retirement hotspots like Amanus. So if we were to include those, then that area would already be way ahead of Johannesburg.
But you also say that Cape Town is expected to overtake Johannesburg, I think, in the next 3 years. Is that then because the city and surrounds is creating more wealth, or as you've suggested, people are simply relocating there because they're tired of, tired of the potholes, I guess?
Yeah. Well, I guess there's a number of factors. It's obviously a very popular lifestyle destination. Also, I think there's been a bit of a switch since COVID in terms of the big corporates, because obviously most of the big JSE listed companies are still based in Johannesburg, mainly in Sandton. And there's been a bit of a switch in terms of hiring senior management, even CEOs for those companies. A lot of them are not actually living in Johannesburg anymore, which is probably quite a negative thing for Johannesburg that they've allowed that. But that's definitely, we see that as having an erosive effect going forward on the amount of high net worths living here. Obviously, the big corporates, the big banks that are here, they can't really relocate to the Western Cape. But what can happen is the directors and the CEOs can live in the Western Cape and then fly up here 3-4 days a week. That's increasingly happening now. That wasn't really tolerated 10 years ago. I don't think many of the corporates would have hired under those circumstances.
Yeah, I think I saw a figure the other day, 54 daily flights now between Johannesburg and Cape Town. On a bigger canvas, Andrew, you forecast the continent's billionaire population rising. Again, correct my numbers if I've misread them, from 28 to more than 120 by 2040. What economic assumptions have to go right for that forecast to happen? Because that's a big jump, right?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, there's inflationary effect, particularly when it comes to billionaires. The numbers tend to rise quicker than the other wealth bands. But there's certain sectors that are growing quite quickly in Africa, especially things like ecotourism, the music and the film industry, also eco-estates. And also, I think the key reason we expect that is we see certain African cities becoming lifestyle destinations for these billionaires going forward, places like Marrakesh, places like Cape Town. We're obviously expecting Europe to continue to struggle, and so it'll become less appealing to high net worths. By 2040, Europe will be, we don't see it as a particularly appealing destination to high net worths, and we think Africa will become more appealing because of that.
And just a quick one in conclusion, Namibia, one of your standout destinations. Why?
Yeah, Namibia is our standout going forward. It has had pretty solid growth recently. And it's also, like South Africa, got quite a well-established luxury residential sector. Plus, the tax rates there are very low. They don't tax foreign earnings. They don't have capital gains tax. And they don't have estate duty. And those are tend to be the three things that wealthy retirees look at. And it's also a relatively safe country compared to the rest of the countries in Africa. So those three factors together, we feel, will reinforce its status and eventually become one of the biggest wealth hubs in Africa.
An interesting body of research. Andrew Amoyles, thank you very much indeed. You're the head of research at New World Wealth. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And that's where we're going to finish today's program. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.